Okay, let's pick up. We left off in the book of Exodus. We left off in chapter 23. Everyone there in the book of Exodus. And basically, chapter 23 is obviously a continuation of what was set forth in these last couple of chapters we went through as far as the covenant that God is entering into with his people. This is basically God gave his people the Ten Commandments, and now what he's going through here is the covenant laws. He's telling them everything that they are required to do, everything that they are to abstain from doing, and all this is part of the covenant. And after he gives them all these covenant laws, then he's going to seal the covenant with a blood sacrifice and sprinkle the blood on the altar and then sprinkle the blood of the sacrificial animal on the people, showing that now God is entering into a covenant with these people. But this is still part of the law of the covenant. And, you know, if some of these laws don't apply today, literally, they certainly apply, okay, as far as the spirit of the law is concerned. In verse 1 in chapter 23, it says, "You shall not carry a false rumor. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness." Okay, it says, don't carry a false rumor or do not join a wicked man. Okay, we can read that, and it can go right over our head because we feel like, well, what has that got to do with me? Or it really doesn't seem to apply. But I'm going to tell you something. Right now, in our society, in America, I mean, it's becoming proverbial. Just the number of lawsuits that are being filed every single day, every single week, every single month, every single year. And they are just flooding and gutting our courts. And how many of these lawsuits are in violation of what we're just reading right now? "You shall not carry a false rumor. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness." Now, I'm going to tell you something right now. So many of these phony, okay, lawsuits as far as, let's say, fender benders, where people are just out to make a buck. I'm just saying this. I'm not trying to be anybody's judge if they say, well, my aching back or my neck or whatever, because people can really legitimately have, you know, whiplash or whatever. So I'm not saying, I'm not lumping them all together, but I am saying that we have gotten to the point now where people are just joining themselves with a wicked person, a lawyer, to be a malicious gossip or a malicious witness in terms of filing a false claim. Now, I'll give you an example, too, okay? You know, Dow Corning basically went bankrupt because of they had come out with these implants for women who wanted to enhance their beauty and whatnot, okay? Well, a lot of these women were then claiming that they had all kinds of negative side effects physically, and they had a whole litany of things that these women were claiming that was wrong with them because of their implants. Well, they went to court, and Dow Corning was sued for billions and billions of dollars, and they filed bankruptcy. And now the reports have come out that these things have never been the cause of any ill side effects and all these things that these women were claiming. But you see, in a situation like this, you get these attorneys that are against these big corporations, for example, and they know all they have to do is get a half a dozen women there with these long, sad stories, and a jury is going to look there, and they're going to say, oh, these poor women, and they're going to look at this big, huge corporation and say, well, these guys are nothing but a bunch of animals. They can afford it. So, in other words, they just completely destroyed a corporation. Now, I'm not trying to defend big companies and big corporations, because I'll tell you right now, I sure have my pet peeves with them, too. All I want to say is, hey, what is happening to justice in this country? What is happening to truth? What is happening to righteousness? It's gone down the tubes, and where it's gone down the tubes the most is in our courts. Our judges and lawyers have made a complete and total mockery of truth and of justice. And so many of the lawsuits that are being filed today, I mean, they're absolutely asinine. I mean, look at the targets they have now. They're going after the tobacco company, and they're going to eventually probably break them, and they're going to end up going bankrupt. Okay, I'm not trying to defend big tobacco, no way, shape, or form. You know, I don't smoke. I mean, I used to smoke, but I don't smoke. I gave it up. I quit. I don't want anybody in my house smoke. Smoke is a noxious habit. Okay, but where are people, I mean, it's like, when are people going to take responsibility for their own decisions? Instead of blaming somebody else, everybody wants to be claimed to be a victim. Well, I'm going to tell you something. We're being judged already for this, but we, on a personal basis, if we have to stand before God, He's not going to buy this kind of stuff. We're going to have to say, well, basically, anybody who does this is really joining themselves with a false witness. They're not taking the personal responsibility for themselves. And it says in verse 2, you shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Now, look at some of the situation. Way back in the 60s, they had the Watts riots, right? But then we had the those riots that we had in the early 90s because of, what's this guy's name? Rodney King, you know, the guy who says, can't we all get along, right? Well, okay, look at the riots that took place there, and look at what people do. I mean, they started burning buildings, they started shooting, they started looting, they started beating the snot out of people, and you know, people were just beaten senseless. Okay, but people could say, well, they got caught up in the moment, and they feel like this is all justified because of some oppression in the past or even in the present or something. Somebody did something wrong to someone somewhere along the line, so this could be justified. But I'm going to tell you something. God is not going to stand for it. What is He saying here? He says, you shall not follow a multitude in doing evil. You know, you don't run with a mob. I'm going to tell you something, too. When it comes to a mob, I mean it. A mob can take on a personality all of its own. And people caught up in a mob will do things that they would never, ever even dream of doing individually. But in the midst of a mob, there's a type of anonymousness there that feels like, hey, I can get away with this. And so they got caught up in the frenzy of the moment, and they can do, you know, the things people end up doing in a riot or a mob or an insurrection, this type of thing. I mean, they would never do individually. That's why God's saying, you know, you're not going to follow a mob to do evil. Because I tell you, a mob can just really, there's no reasoning with a mob. Look what happened to the mob on Good Friday that the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the scribes stirred up against Christ, and not even Pilate, the governor, could control it. These people were the same ones who were shouting Hosanna in the highest a week before, but look at how they turned on a totally vicious, evil, wicked personality began to transform itself within these people because they became a mob. And I'm going to tell you something, man. If you ever see it happening, get away. Get away from it. We're living in a society today where it's very, very possible for something like this could break out anywhere. Because more and more, our laws are breaking down where anarchy is beginning to take over. And, you know, the Bible says very plainly, don't follow these people, you know, to do evil. And it says, nor shall you testify in dispute so as to turn aside a multitude in order to pervert justice. That's exactly what happened to Christ, isn't it? Okay, but this is exactly what happens as well, you know, when people incite riots. You know, and we're seeing more and more of it. Then he says in verse 3, he says, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. And I like this, okay? It would almost seem like we should be reading, you shall not be partial to a rich man in his dispute. But it's not saying that, is it? Look what it's saying. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. There's always a tendency, especially for a quote-unquote bleeding heart, quote-unquote liberal, and I'm not trying to put any labels on anybody, but you know what I'm talking about here, right? To say, well, this person's the underdog, so therefore this person can get away with it. I gave you this example a few weeks ago, but I think it's a classic example. And right now in San Francisco, there's this big upheaval that's going over about all the homeless people with their shopping carts. And so the people want to say, well, listen, these people are homeless, therefore they should be allowed to have these shopping carts. They're being partial to a poor man, aren't they? In other words, bottom line is this. Because he's poor, she's poor, because they're homeless, therefore it is justifiable for them to steal something that doesn't belong to them and utilize it for their own personal, you know, possessions or whatever else they need. But I'm just saying this, okay? That's stealing. That is wrong.
and it should be condemned as wrong. I don't care whether they're poor or whether they're homeless or whether they're free, black, white, male, female, rich, poor, whatever. Okay, whenever we start saying, okay, listen, this person's an underdog, this person's a poor person, therefore justice should not apply to that person. The rules of law should not apply to these individuals. Then we're really going down the wrong road. Because where do you draw the line then? You see what I'm saying? I don't. In God's eyes, he is not only is he colorblind as far as race, you know, there's no partiality whatsoever as far as God is concerned. He doesn't care whether you're rich or poor. Okay? These people have no right taking what belongs to a company. I don't care how rich the company is. And saying, well, I deserve it. I'm entitled to it because I'm poor. No, you're not. You're not entitled to it. It doesn't belong to you. The Bible does say in the book of James that there's a wisdom from above that's pure and it's peaceable and it's insightful and all of these other things. But there's also a wisdom from below that's earthly and demonic and sensual. Okay? So what so much today is passing as wisdom and compassion is anything but wisdom. There's no common sense to it. Okay, as far as God is concerned. And he says here at verse 4, it says, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. You shall see the donkey, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it to him. Okay, it says here, you know, here's a situation where Christ put this in perspective as far as saying, you are to love your enemies. Okay, to do good to those, okay, who hate you, who despitefully use you, to pray for those who despitefully use you. I mean, he turned his whole situation around, but yet, where did this come from? It came from the Old Testament, basically loving your enemies. Because here, he said, if you see your oxen, neighbor's oxen wandering away, you have a moral obligation to return it to him. Okay? Hey, believe me, I've been tempted so much. There's been a couple times in this neighborhood where people's dogs have gotten loose, and I want so bad to just call up, you know, the SPA. Hey, pick this dog up, okay? I had them do that to a stray once, but I ended up tying this neighbor's dog up here. My neighbor's dog, who thank God he's passed away, poor thing. But he was across the street, okay, and he just drove me crazy with his barking, just crazy. And sometimes I just dream of strangling this dog. But I knew it was my neighbor's dog. So when the pound came out to get the stray, I took this dog and I tied it up in back so it wouldn't be hauled off. But I wanted so bad to throw this thing in the pound too. But it was my neighbor's dog, so I knew that, okay, you know, I had to do the right thing as far as God was concerned. But I believe me, the temptation was there. But if you're going to love your neighbor as yourself, you're going to have to, you know, sometimes it's really going to be caught, huh?
Love their dog.
Well, believe me, I mean, yeah. Well, believe me, that was a hard lesson. There's nothing easy for me around. It says in verse 5, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. In other words, if you see your neighbor over there trying to get your donkey up because he can't get up because he's got this load on his back, your action is to go over to your neighbor and try to give him a hand. Okay? For a Christian, it would be like, what if your worst enemy is out there with a flat tire or something or needs a broken down on the side of the road? You know, you don't go flying by giving him a finger. You know, you say, okay, what can I do to help you? Okay, what is this teaching us? Well, it's what Christ has taught us, okay, as far as going the extra mile, giving more than is demanded. I mean, this is really putting Christianity into action. I mean, when people say, I don't believe in the God of the Old Testament, I believe in the God of the New Testament, and they quote something like, well, I don't believe in all these regulations of the Old Testament, but I believe in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, I can say this. You better read the Sermon on the Mount. Because I'm going to tell you this right now, what's required there is just, it transcends anything that's humanly possible. It's going to take the grace of God to enable us to be able to do things like loving our enemies like we love ourselves, or when somebody smacks you on the cheek, turn the other cheek, or somebody compels you to go a mile, go an extra mile, or somebody demands your shirt to give me your coat, or your coat, you give me your shirt as well, this type of thing. Believe me, that doesn't come natural. Somebody smashed me on the face, I want to just turn around and smack them right back. That's my immediate response. okay, don't turn my, give them another chance, crack at me, you know, but again, it's going to take the grace of God to be able to do it. Otherwise, we can't possibly do it apart from God's grace. He says in verse 6, he says, you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Okay, so here, okay, it says, don't pervert justice for a poor man. In other words, simply because a man is poor, you don't end up perverting justice in his favor because he's poor. But at the same time, if you look at the situation, you don't take the other approach too. If he's poor, you don't take advantage of him. Okay? It's a sword that cuts both ways. All right, when it comes to justice. He says in verse 7, says, keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. He says, keep far from a false charge. I mean, this is something that we really have to, work at, especially in today, because so many things are being compromised to the point where black and white has become a thousand shades of gray. And it's easy to say, well, gee, you know, I can make a couple of $1,000 by, saying that I was hurt in this fender bender when I wasn't. That's a false charge. Or it says just to not kill an innocent or righteous person. I mean, let me tell you something right now. We've already slaughtered 37 million unborn children, and they are innocent and they are righteous in God's eyes. Because what does he say here? I will not acquit the guilty. We think this country thinks it can get away with what it's done. No way. I mean, God in his mercy has been long-suffering. He's been patient. He's been forbearing with us. But, man, I just almost cringe when I try to think or imagine what's going to happen as a result of this nation slaughtering the righteous and the innocent to the extent, to the degree that we have. There's no question about it. He says here, I'm not going to acquit the guilty. And he says in verse 8, he says, you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. Look what's happening today in our Congress, in our legislature, in our government. These guys, okay, they don't call it bribes, but I'm going to tell you something. Every special interest group that goes up to them, that plops down money to say, hey, vote our way, is that not a bribe? Is that not a bribe? I mean, this is where these special interest groups, these lobbyists, need to be packed up and sent home on a bus. I mean it. I mean, if I was president, if I had control over it, I'd say, hey, you're all out of here. But they don't call them bribers. They call them lobbyists. Okay? And Christians can have lobbyists too. This is what's happening, is everything's being perverted because these guys in office feel like, hey, I can get $200,000 by voting this particular way on this particular issue, and I can get this amount of money for my campaign so I can be reassured that I can get reelected. Well, you're taking a bribe. I guarantee it, in God's eyes, you're taking a bribe, and what's happening? Your vision is being clouded. You're not seeing clearly when you take this. He says in verse 9, he says, and you shall not oppose a stranger, since you yourselves know the feeling of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. Okay, now, we're a country of immigrants, okay, and it's easy for people to begin to resent other people that come into this country or begin to oppose them. But again, what's happening now, I think, is almost just the opposite in this country. It's what happened with God told Israel what would happen to them if they forsook him. He's told them that they would always be the head and the other nations would be the tail, so to speak. But he said that they began to disobey him and turn from him and turn from their righteousness into wicked ways, that he would eventually turn things around where they would become the tail and other people the head. Well, that's what's happening in this country in many respects. And you know who's becoming more and more oppressed? Is the majority, okay, that are becoming oppressed, all right? And more people, it's like all these different groups now, the one group that's very easy to bash and very easy to oppress is the Christians. This is what's happening. We become strangers in our own land, so to speak, as a judgment. And in verse 10 it says, you shall sow your land and for 6 years and gather in its yield, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you are to do. Okay, now here he's talking about what was referred to as the sabbatical year. Every seventh year you were to let your fields lie fallow. In other words, you were to go ahead and plow them, but you weren't to sow them. You weren't to sow seed in them. You were allow your let your land rest. Okay? It was going to be the sabbatical year. Let your land rest. God had a very good reason for this. He had a number of reasons, but one of the reasons was this. We know today that if you continue to plant crops in the same soil year after year after year without allowing it to rest, it's not going to be able to replenish its nutrients and all the chemicals and the compositions that it needs to be able to grow crops that are very nutritious. Well, God knew that the land needed to rest. Well, what happened? Well, God gave them this law, but they didn't keep the law. Okay? For 490 years, they completely ignored this law. God never said a thing to them. God never did anything to them. For 490 years, they continued to break the sabbatical year. They would plant anyway, thinking, well, gee, I don't know if I could trust God, or else, hey, I can make extra money. Why let the land go to waste? So they would plant anyway, and they would reap, and they would harvest, and they would sow, and they would sell. Thinking, well, we're getting away with this. God hasn't done anything yet. But what happened 490 years later when God threw them out of the land because he said, now you've gone too far. Your stench of your sin and your disobedience and your rebellion has risen up to my nostrils. I'm not going to take any more. He threw them out of the land. Jeremiah said, you are going to be captives and you are going to be exiled into Babylon for 70 years. And God came to that figure of 70 years based on the fact that they did not keep the sabbatical year for 490 years. In other words, God was going to give the land 70 years to lie there fallow, to lie there without being plowed, because he threw the people out. He says, now my land is going to get its rest. See, we think we're getting away with something. We've already slaughtered 37 million children, and God hasn't come down, you know, and annihilated this nation or wiped it off the face of the earth. So we're thinking, he doesn't care. Well, what's he going to do? Big deal. Well, I'm telling you, he doesn't forget. He didn't forget. He kept a record the whole time. So, in other words, to keep this sabbatical year was not only help replenish the soil, but what would it do for the people? Not just give them a rest, but what would it do for their faith? Okay, now they have to trust God. So the sixth year God promised, I'll give you a bumper crop. Okay, the sixth year you get a bumper crop, and then you store it up in your barns. The seventh year you go ahead and plow your ground, but then you let it lie fallow, okay? And it'll show that you put your trust in me, that you have your faith and confidence in me, that I will provide for you, that I will care for you. Well, every time they did, they disobeyed God, it would just show, it showed a lack of faith. There's a lack of trust here, right? But God not only gave him this commission, this command, for the sake of the land and for the exercise of their faith in him, but he also gave it for the needy of the land, the poor, the stranger, the alien, and the animals. He said this, don't plant anything, and whatever grows by itself, whether it come off of your fruit trees or, you know, or out of the fields or whatever grows by itself, you are to allow that poor to have that. See, this was one of God's provisions for the poor. He says in verse 13, he says, now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on guard. Do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. Okay, he's telling here, first of all, to be on guard, simply because there's always a tendency when you let down your guard, when you're not diligent in terms of always keeping what God has said, told us, or commanded us in front of our eyes, it's easy to be misled. He says, I don't even want you mentioning the name of God. I think what he's referring to here is he doesn't want you mentioning their name in terms of prayer. Because the Bible mentions some of these other gods, like Moloch and the gods of the Amorites and whatnot. Okay, the names of them. Okay, but he was just basically telling these people they are never to turn to these other gods in prayer or to offer sacrifice for them or to ask for intercession from them or whatnot. Okay, they had to be very, very cautious of that, diligent about that. And we ourselves have got to be that, on that way in terms of we have to be on our guard in terms of the idols that could easily be set up in our heart, could easily be there. Well, one of the things that can take root so tenaciously and we don't even realize it is money. Material things. And you don't have to be rich to have it take root in your heart. Well, what does the Bible say? It says, hey, keep your mind on things above rather than things of earth. And that's a very difficult thing to do, but you know, we really have to make a concerted effort to do that, to keep our minds on God rather than to get all bogged down in the things below. Now, granted, we have to, we need a monetary exchange in terms of being able to live, so money is very much a part of our living. Matter of fact, in Proverbs, there's at least 40 admonitions in terms of how to deal with money and finances and investments and these type of things. So God is not opposed to it. It's just simply that it's so easy to begin to take over or precede God in terms of his importance. And he says here in verse 14, he says, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. He says, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you are not to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time of the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Now what he's saying here is he's instituting this law of the covenant. And he's saying that there's 3 different feast days that they had to observe. And they had to observe it in this manner. All the males that were over a certain age, I think around they were 18 or 21 and over, they had to go down to Jerusalem 3 times a year, and they had to present to God a sacrifice, okay, an offering, and they had to worship God down there in Jerusalem. Now, he gave them 3 times a year they had to do this, and one of them was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, that was coupled with the Passover, because the Passover was on the 14th of their first day of the month, first day of the year, excuse me, which is called Abib. For us, their first month, Abib, is our mid-March and mid-April. All right. So anyway, in other words, they had to go down there for that Feast of Unleavened Bread, but it started with the Passover, and then the 7 days after that. Well, God wanted to remember that needed to be commemorated. The Passover, of course, was to be remembered in terms of their deliverance from Egypt. That's where they had that Passover. All right, the Passover was pointing to Christ as being our Passover lamb, Passover sacrifice. So in other words, it was to commemorate their salvation, their redemption. And then afterwards, they had for 7 days, they had to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread, where they could not have any leaven whatsoever in anything they ate. They couldn't even have it in their home under the pain of being excommunicated. The leaven represented corruption, moral corruption, bad theology. Like Jesus said, beware the corrupt, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, beware the leavens of the Herodians, beware. You know, the leaven can represent bad doctrine, moral corruption, immorality, this type of thing. This is leaven. In other words, it pointed to us that when we accept Christ, that's the Passover. He comes into our life, we are cleansed with his blood, but then from there on out, we have to cleanse the leaven from our life. In terms of if we have anything in our home that could be considered leaven, whether it be pornography, whether it be occultic books or Ouija boards, tarot cards, you know, palm reading stuff, all this kind of stuff got to go because that's leaven, all right? And they had to celebrate that they had to observe that for 7 days, okay? The 7 being the number of perfection or totality or completeness, symbolizing the rest of the whole life. Yeah, this is the earliest you've ever been late. What was it? An hour late. An hour.
I'm really lucky to be
yes. Oh, I know. We're lucky to have you. Yeah. Yeah. See. So, well, next time, let's see if we can get here for the blessing next time. The clothing man says, I knew it was something. He knew I got cookies this time. Okay. Anyway, the next one he says, verse 16, you shall observe the feast of harvest of the first fruits of your labors that you should sow in the field. Also the feast of ingathering at the end of the year when you're gathering the fruit of your labors from the fields. Okay, this fruit of harvest, this was the also known as the Feast of Weeks. In the New Testament, it's referred to as Pentecost. Okay, Pentecost means 50, and it was actually this Feast of Weeks was supposed to be 7 weeks after the Passover celebration. So you had a situation where you had 49 days or 50 days. Well, what that pointed to was the first fruits, okay, where people had to go down there and they give the first fruits of their harvest to God, all right? Well, in the New Testament, the Pentecost was the day that we celebrated. Remember what happened the first day of Pentecost was that after Christ had ascended or, you know, rose from the dead, okay, well, 50 days later or 49, 7 weeks later, then you had the Holy Spirit descend upon the apostles and they ascended upon them and, you know, with a rushing wind and tongues of fire upon their head. Then Peter went out and he preached a powerful gospel, a sermon that day, and 3,000 people were saved. Well, they were the first fruits of, okay, the church that were commemorated. And then he says here, also, they were to keep the feast of ingathering. In other words, at the end of the year, after they gather in all their harvest, okay, they already gave God the first fruits, but then at the end of the harvest, they would go back and they were to give God thanks for everything that he did. And I think this is where there is the ingathering. There's also the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, where they commemorated or remembered. They would live in booths or tabernacles there, they'd tell their children why they were living in these tents, temporary tents, to kind of point back to the time that they lived in tents in Egypt and that God provided for them and he cared for them. And so they had to always be remindful of God for all that he has given them. That's why they call it a Feast of Ingathering. All the blessings that they had gathered, they were to be mindful to God for. And look at how God has been so gracious to this nation. I mean, how he has blessed this nation beyond any nation on earth. No doubt, with all the material things and the blessings he gives us, it's just phenomenal the way this nation has been blessed. But look what we've done. We have forgotten God. We've turned our back on God. We don't really give the thanks that we need to give to God. But I'm going to tell you something. When you see an ungrateful spirit in somebody, it really, really shows a smallness of character. And I'm going to tell you, this nation is becoming more and more ungrateful to God, to its creator, to one who has given us all these things. And look at this. Our character is just completely in the toilet, isn't it, as a nation? And you can see it because of our ingratitude. And believe me, you know, it's going to come back to us. And it says here in 17, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord. Now, all the males over a certain age would go down there before God. It was the males because they represented their family. Okay, they were the heads of the households, and they, as such, they would go on down there to represent their family before God. And verse 18 says, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. In other words, nothing that you offer to God, okay, was to have leaven in it. In other words, when we offer sacrifice to God, it's not to be mingled with what? Corruption or immorality or impurity or this type of thing. When we give to God a sacrifice, it's to be a pure sacrifice. And he says here that none of the fat of his feast is to remain overnight until morning. In other words, the offering, the sacrificial animal, everything was to be burned. In other words, like, for example, if you had a peace offering or whatever and you got a portion of it, whatever remained had to be burned up before the next day. And that, to me, is also significant because it's like God wants us to seek him anew each and every day. In other words, you can't get to a situation where you just say, well, yesterday I had a really good quiet time with the Lord. I really had a mountaintop experience with God, and I really communed with him, and it was just really great. I say, well, that's wonderful, but what about today? Okay? I think too many people have gotten into this situation, probably especially in my own denomination, where they just feel like, well, you go to church once a week, it's the be kind to God day, you know, that kind of mentality. This is Sunday, so we go to church. But then where is he the rest of the week? You see what I'm saying? In other words, Hey, that was last week. That was last Sunday. What about today? How much have you sought him in as far as his word, as far as in prayer, as far as in fellowship, this type of thing? Okay? Because yesterday was yesterday. Last year was last year. Hey, this is a new day. It says here in verse 19, it says, you shall bring the choice fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a kid in its own, as the milk of its mother. First, in that first part of that 19, you shall bring the choice fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. In other words, when you do bring your first fruits, you are to bring the best of your first fruits, okay? Look what happened to the people there in Malachi's day, okay? They got to the point where what were they doing? They thought, well, I'm going to offer this animal to God, but what kind of offering were they giving to God? They were giving to God their lame and their sick and their blind and their diseased animals. So they're like, well, hey, we'll give this to God because, you know, it's kind of worthless. It won't bring a lot of money on the marketplace or whatever, so we'll give it to God. Okay, well, what happened there was that God rebuked them. He says, hey, try giving that to your governor and see what he does. He'll slam the door right in your face, right? I mean, and God says, hey, I'm a great king, and you want to bring all these sick and these lame and these worthless animals to me and say, well, we're offering it to God? Well, the same principle applies to us. I mean, what do we give to God? And not just, I'm talking about money. I'm not talking about just money. I mean, I talk about as far as our life is concerned. Do we give God the best of our day or the best that we have? Do we give him our all in what we do for him? Or is it just simply the leftovers or we'll get around to it kind of mentality? You see what I'm saying? I mean, we got to recognize that we're dealing with a great king here. And he is deserving of our best and our best effort. And not shoddy work, not shoddy attempts to, you know, I don't care what you're doing, whether it's you're teaching a Sunday school class or whether you're singing in the choir or whether you're preaching a sermon or whether, well, if you're doing this for God, you just don't give him the leftovers. I mean, you really got to give it your absolute best. Why? Because he's deserving of it. See what I'm saying? And he says, that latter part of that, you are not to boil a kid in the milk of his mother. Has caused a lot of, consternation. It's caused a lot of confusion. People don't know exactly what it's referring to. There's two ways of looking at this. One is this. Boiling a kid in his mother's milk could mean, well, you don't take a newborn calf or a kid, you know, an animal from its mother, and you cook it up to eat it. Okay? You are to allow it to mature and to grow. But I don't think that's what it's referring to. I think, as a matter of fact, there was some commentaries about there being an occultic practice back in the 15th century where some of these pagans would do this. They would boil these young kids in their mother's milk in the sense that they would, boil them along with their mother as an occultic rite, for some type of divination, okay? Oh, it's like even in parts of the world today, but they used to do it back then. They would, for example, cut open an animal, spill out its guts and its entrails, and try to predict the future through how they would lay out. You never heard of that?
Yeah.
You've heard of that type of thing. Well, I think this has something to do with that boiling a kid in its mother's milk. It was an occultic practice that was used to try to divine or a type of divination to try to foretell the future or tell, you know, to learn of certain events, certain circumstances, this type of thing, or to find direction or whatever, okay? And then he says here in that verse 20, he says, behold, I am going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Now, when he's talking about he's going to send his angel before him, we know that from all these other contexts of Scripture that this angel very often would be referred to as being the Lord. So we know it as being the angel of the Lord, okay? Now, I want to clarify this, okay? This appears to be God the Father speaking, and he's talking about, you know, sending his angel. The angel is the pre-incarnate Christ. Now, Christ is not an angel, okay? Jehovah's Witnesses say that Jesus Christ is Michael the Archangel. Well, that's nonsense, okay? What he's referring to here is that angel means messenger, all right? And basically, Christ is God's messenger. He is God's word to us, right? Well, Here, he's saying that Christ is going to go before them. This is the pre-incarnate Christ, and God demands absolute obedience to him. He says in verse 21, it says, "Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious towards him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, since my name is in him." Okay, the two are basically one. He says, "But if you truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries." Now, here's a condition. Again, I think we see this time and time and time again in Scripture, that God is saying, hey, if you do this, I'll do that. If you do that, I'll do this. This is another conditional promise that basically boils down to this. If we obey God, okay, God is going to do what? He's going to be an enemy to our enemies. And our number one enemy is who?
Satan.
The devil. Believe me, when God is fighting for you, the Bible, like Jesus himself says, stronger is he that is in you than he is in the world. Okay, we have absolutely no defense against him or no power over him apart from the power of God. And he says in verse 23, he says, "For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hevites and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them." Now, in reading this, again, people can say, well, this just seems very harsh of God to bring these people into a land and then have the people of the land destroyed and give all of their property and their land and their houses over to these other people. That just doesn't seem fair. But keep something in mind. Again, God is no respecter of persons, because God told them very plainly, hey, I'm going to give you this land. First of all, I'm going to have you throw out these other people because of their wickedness, because of their violence, because of their idolatry, their immorality, their ungodliness, and everything else. I want these people destroyed, and I want them removed. But then God has told them later, his own people, that if you start acting like those people, I'm going to throw you out too. See? God's no respecter of persons. I mean, we're told that basically, and Paul tells us in Romans, in the New Testament, that there will be tribulation and distress for everyone, the Jew first and the Greek second, or the Gentile. Okay, everyone who does evil in the sight of God. So it's like, hey, God's no respecter of persons here. He ended up throwing out his people more than once because of their wickedness. So, and in verse 24, it says, "You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces." That's a pretty straightforward command, okay? Don't worship their gods. The problem is, we today have this, I guess, this mental image of these people's gods, which they were carved out of wood and silver and stone and gold and whatnot, and they would bow down and offer incense to them and stuff like that. Okay, well, when it says here, "You shall not worship their gods nor serve them," okay? Keep something in mind. Remember, we went back in the book of Daniel when we read about how Belshazzar, who was the king of Babylon at the time, he was throwing his big drunken orgy party, and he took out all the utensils and the cups and the whatnot from the temple that had been confiscated from Jerusalem. And they were all drinking and getting drunk. And then remember the hand that came out? And it started writing on the wall, "Meeny, meeny, tekoa, parson." Nobody could figure out what it meant, but then finally got Daniel in there, and he says that he told the king, he says, "Hey, man, you blew it. You blew it." Because what were they doing with all of these utensils? It says that they were drinking and praising the gods of silver and gold and iron and bronze and wood and these various things, right? They were praising them as being God. They were sacrilegious or blasphemous. They were being really blasphemous. But today, we do the same thing. We really elevate the gods of what? Gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone, these type of things, before God in terms of their materialistic value or their monetary value or this type of thing. And what do? We serve them. Okay? I mean, it doesn't take a genius to be able to make this mental leap, because there is none in terms of, hey, this is the same thing as far as God is concerned when it comes to sacrificing to other gods or worshiping other gods or serving other gods. But he says here, "You shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces." In other words, in our hearts is where God's throne should reside, and that's where he should reside, and not be, and not have anything else where God belongs in that heart, in our heart. It says, verse 25, "But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days." I will. Okay, so he says here, if you obey me, I will fulfill the number of your days. All right? Meaning what? You're going to live a long, good life. Okay? But we all know, back then as well as today, we all have seen good people die young and real worthless cruds live on and on and on and on and on, haven't we? I mean, we've seen it. I've seen it time and time again. Right? We've all seen it in our lifetime. Remember the fourth commandment where it says, honor your mother and your father. It's the only commandment with a promise. What was the promise? So they can have a long life, prosperous life, okay? It was the only command with a promise, right? But we all know that some children, some sons and daughters who have honored their parents have died young. And we also know that some children, some sons and daughters who have dishonored their parents and disrespected their parents live on and on and on and on. So does that mean that God's conditions or that his promises are worthless or nil or void? No. What it means is a general principle to be applied in a societal way. What do I mean by this? If you have a society where basically all the children honor their parents, well, their parents are going to be basically, if they love God, and even if they don't love God, because Jesus said this, he says, which one of you parents, which one of you being evil, know how to give your children good gifts? How much more your heavenly Father will know how to give good gifts? Remember that when he said that? Okay. Well, keep this in mind. If your parents are raising you and they love you and they say, hey, stay away from this type of activity. Stay away from drugs. Stay away from the wrong crowd. In other words, when they're giving you all these different instructions, if you honor your parents and obey your parents, guess what? Chances are you're going to live longer. Why?
Spare yourself from all the trouble and could get into and all.
Like, for example, okay, look up all the number of people that die from AIDS. Okay? This is basically something that is done, that is contracted through behavior, through using intravenous drugs, through using illegal drugs, and from sexual promiscuity. All right? But if a society listens to its parents and they abstain from that, well, the chances are you're not going to die young. You're not going to die young from AIDS. You're not going to die young from a drunken car wreck. You're not going to die, by being murdered, by hanging around the wrong crowd, and so on and so forth. You see what I'm trying to say? I'm really doing a terrible job of trying to explain this. But what I'm saying is that by honoring your parents, chances are you're going to live long. Okay? Even if you don't individually, societally, you will. This is the same principle that's applied here. That if a society will obey God, the people in that society in general will live a long, good, prosperous life. Simply because, okay, they are obeying what God has commanded, and therefore they are reaping what they have sown. You see what I'm saying? See, just by simply putting God's principles into action, you don't even have to believe in God, in a sense, to reap the benefits of the things that he's commanded. Then he says here, in verse 27, it says, I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. He's basically saying this, that when they get into the land, if they obey him, he's going to drive out from before them the people of the land. He's going to kick them out for them. And he says here, I will send hornets ahead of you that they may drive out the Hivites and the Canaanites and the Hittites before you. In other words, he's saying here, I will send insects before you to drive them out as you begin to expand. Your population begins to increase, and you begin to take over more and more land. God is going to deal with these. And how is he going to deal with these nations? Through nature. Here he says hornets, but this is a general application. God very often sends his judgments against the ungodly. How? Through nature. I mean, we are definitely under bombardment of God's judgment as far as, you know, they refer to it as Mother Nature, and they want to give God the credit. But I'm going to tell you, we are being inundated and flooded and gutted with what? Hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and droughts and forest fires and earthquakes. I mean, on and on and on, aren't we? These are God's judgments against this nation. Because what? Because we've turned on him. Then he says here, I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. So in other words, this is God's way in his wisdom of allowing the people room to grow and to expand as they populate, and he's going to deal with the problems as they come up. I mean, very often, like Jesus said, hey, give us this day our daily bread, right? For example, he says, give us this day our daily bread. By nature, I think we all want to say, Lord, give us enough cash for next year so we can just sit back and feel a little relaxed about things. No, he will meet our needs as the needs, progress, or as the needs appear. This is the way he's meeting their needs. Then he says here in that verse 30, he says, I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. And verse 31, and I will fix your boundaries from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness of the river Euphrates, and I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hands, and you will drive them out before you. And you shall... Okay, what he's basically saying is he's going to give them, or he's promising to give them the land. And I don't know if you can see it on a map there, but from the Mediterranean Sea all the way over to the Euphrates River, that's at least 600-700 miles. Well, they've never possessed that kind of land, but they will possess it during the millennial period when Christ rules and reigns. They will finally have possessed the land that God had promised Abraham and he promises them. But again, it's like taking one step at a time in terms of God's blood. He doesn't give it to us all at once, but he gives us the grace that we need for the moment and for whatever the needs may call for, even our own life. And that includes even dying, even death. I mean, God's not going to give us the grace today to die if we're not going to die for another 10 years. He will give us that grace when that time comes. You see what I'm saying? When the need arises, then he will be there to provide the grace and the provisions that we need at the moment. And he says, in verse 32, it says, you shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And he's talking about these people of the land. In other words, don't intermingle with these people and start making covenants with their god. Because if you start mingling with these people, you're going to end up worshiping their gods. And if you end up worshiping your gods, it's going to become a snare to you. Okay? It's the old saying, bad company corrupts good morals. Well, that's the same. The application is there. It's exactly the same. If we're going to hang around with the wrong crowd, we're obviously going to be influenced by that crowd. Okay? There's no question about it. Let me put it this way. It doesn't tell me anything about you, or it doesn't tell you anything about me, if I spend 8 hours at my job, okay, and the people that I work with and are for are under or around, that doesn't tell you anything about me, really. It can give you my name, rank, and serial number, but it doesn't tell you anything about me personally. You know what can tell you a lot about me is when I get off my job, when I leave my job, when I no longer have to be at a certain place for a particular reason, for our responsibility, then where do I go? And you see what I'm saying? What do you do with that time? Well, it also tells you that what kind of people you can hang around with. You see what the point is? How it'll become a snare to you if you hang around the wrong people. And when it becomes a snare to you, it's going to be your ruin, your destruction. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?